Hello, welcome to the episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Jeff, how are you today?
I'm wonderful, Sal. How about you?
I'm doing wonderful.
Good, good. Who you got for us today?
We have a new guest. She's never been with us before.
Uh-oh.
But she is with Forge Genetics International and Dr. Erica Rodbell. Doctor, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we've got a little tradition. We have to start with the question of the day, everybody has to do this. But what is, Dr. Rodbell, what is the dumbest or most simple thing that you've ever procrastinated on?
Oh, you're going to find out a lot about me.
Just by this, by one question?
going to the grocery store.
You put that off?
I'll do the everything but the kitchen sink kind of dinner, and then I'll sit down and be like, all right, I can't push this envelope any farther.
You're down to mac and cheese.
Yep.
But it just forces you to be creative with what you have.
Exactly. All you need is some meat, maybe some carbs of some sort.
That's funny.
I don't know.
Jeff, what have you ever procrastinated on?
You know, mine is probably, and I do this every year, of course, I'm the king of procrastination, but probably my taxes. And it's just, you know, getting everything ready to go to the accountant. And then, you know, once you actually jump into it and actually do it, it doesn't take that long.
Just a few hours, probably.
But it's that process of getting ready. And I put it off. And then you sit down in your office, you're going to put everything together. And then you find other things you can do to keep procrastinating. But then when you finally do it, it's not that bad. But every year I do it, I'll do it again this next year.
I think mine is probably like small maintenance issues, like little bitty tiny things that I probably need to get somebody to help me with, like the brakes on my dump truck. I need to get them fixed, but it's parked at dad's right now. And I should have called somebody yesterday to come look at them, but I'll just keep putting it off. But
then eventually you'll really, really need it and you won't have brakes.
I'll just keep adding more brake fluid. I don't know where it's going, but it's still stopping. So I'm still working.
I'm glad I don't live in the same county. I won't be run over by a dump truck.
Dr. Rodbell, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got here today. Your career path.
Well, it's a very long and windy story, I guess you could say. I was born and raised and went to college in New York.
New York City or?
No.
State?
Very north, just south of the Adirondack Mountains.
Oh, wow. Pretty country up there.
It's very pretty. It's very pretty, especially this time of year, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And then I went to Iowa State, where I did my master's in entomology and sustainable agriculture. Did my PhD up in Montana State University. So progressively moving west.
Yeah.
And then got into the alfalfa weevil, which we'll talk about later on the show. And Emily Message actually scooped me up basically from the jump. And now I'm here in Idaho.
Well, that was not that windy, but it was a lot of miles. For sure.
A lot of miles. Yeah.
I see a trend in my parking lot right now. Yeah, there's a trend of wanting to go to pretty country. I mean, you ended up in Montana, now Idaho, I mean, and started in upstate New York. That's you have been in some areas with some very pretty countrysides.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
How did you
find? You can't really put me in a city. I don't do well there.
How did you and Emily find each other?
Well, Emily worked at Montana State University before I arrived, and in essence, she knew my PhD advisor, and one of her employees saw me give a talk at a conference, and we got introduced, and then we started having monthly calls, and the next thing I know, I'm driving a U-Haul truck from Bozeman, Montana to Idaho.
Wow.
And we're here.
How long have you been in the position you're at now with Forge Genetics with FGI?
9 months.
9 months. Very good. Mm-hmm. Well, we're here to talk about the bane of alfalfa, is the dreaded alfalfa weevil. And we still have a lot of dairy in this area, and certainly a lot of livestock cattle production. And alfalfa is a good crop with us, and you're going to talk a little bit about alfalfa weevil resistance, insecticide resistant. So tell us, I think Jeff is going to sit and listen. I don't know if he's going to contribute too much, and I know I'm not.
Well, we've got to back up. So did you do your undergrad in entomology?
No, actually. So I went to college at a small private school called St. Lawrence University, right on the St. Lawrence River Seaway, and I majored in conservation biology. So entomology wasn't a course that was taught, and yes, the student-to-teacher ratio is very low, but those specialty classes, those that are keystone, pivotal courses for any kind of biology degree, land-grant institutions have. And so it was definitely a big learning curve for me when I jumped into a master's program in entomology and sustainable agriculture.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a bit of a leap to say all of a sudden I'm going to go, let's go to look at bugs.
Yeah, how did you, that's got to be tough.
Well, so I knew from early on that I really wanted to do field work. I liked being outside. I didn't like being inside in a lab. I definitely didn't enjoy that part of biology. But I wanted to be outside when the sun was out and inside when it was raining and cold. And guess where insects are not when it's rainy and cold.
And so she's a thinker.
So I strategically chose something that let me be outside when I wanted to be outside and inside when I wanted to be inside. So
very good.
That's how I got to where I am today.
Sal and I, we never put that much thought into anything. No, so that's kudos to you. Okay. Now we got that settled. Now you're in Idaho and you're working on alfalfa weevil. What can you tell us all about alfalfa weevil?
Yeah.
So I would just like to preface this by saying the weevil work that I have done is basically focused on my time at Montana State University.
Okay.
So during that time, we knew that there was a fair bit of issue with the management of alfalfa weevil. It's, been in the country for over 120 years now, and it's just becoming more and more of a threat. And the tools that have been registered for the protection against this pest species are becoming increasingly restricted. And on top of that, resistance is developing. Mm-hmm. So the whole premise of my PhD research was to figure out where this issue was in the West, Intermountain West, and how extensive of a problem was it? Like, is the entire class of insecticides not useful anymore? Or is it specifically tailored to one? Is resistance strictly to one insect active ingredient? And what we found was the entire class of insecticides. If you have resistance to one, you have resistance to, in essence, all. So that's what my PhD project was focused on.
Are there different types of weevil? Is an alfalfa weevil in Montana the same as the one we'd see in southern Indiana?
Short answer is it depends. long answer is there are three known accidental introductions of the alfalfa weevil into the contiguous United States, with each introduction being recognized as a distinct strain. The Egyptian strain in Yuma, Arizona, the Western strain was first identified in Salt Lake City, Utah. And then in the 1950s, we have the Eastern strain identified in, I believe it was Maryland. And one thing that we, as a group of scientists, as entomologists, are debating right now is whether or not the Egyptian strained alfalfa weevil is a distinct species from the Western and Eastern strains. In essence, because they don't readily cross. They can't produce viable offspring all the time, and has something to do with the bacteria that they have.
Oh, that's interesting.
I just assumed there was alfalfa weevil. Was it alfalfa weevil?
I did too.
Yeah. So is there any of those species easier to kill than others?
They're all... They all impact, regardless as to what strain you have. Their primary host is alfalfa. you know, reports have come from coast to coast about pyrethroid insecticides no longer being effective. The map hasn't really had enough time to become well known, or at least filled in. But I can tell you that there are three counties in eastern Pennsylvania that have pyrethroid resistance, or at least suspected pyrethroid resistance. What I can tell you is that Iowa is increasingly concerned about this issue, because they too have heard and are aware of lack of efficacy or reduced efficacy of these insecticides due to resistance. And Minnesota is also there. And then if you go west, the map becomes a whole lot more well known.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like that's one thing with pyrethroids, like with Lambda. I mean, it used to be fairly easily. We go out and spray with Warrior, and that seemed to work really well 20 years ago. And then it just seems like now it's more frequently we're going out making an application and then not having near the efficacy that we think we ought to have after an application like that. So certainly, I guess, to explain what tools do we have if we can't go out and spray pyrethroids?
Well, one thing that is becoming more and more apparent is, you know, the EPA is looking at insecticides with a fine tooth comb, and, you know, Loris Ban has long been used for the management of this pest. Obviously, it's becoming more and more tricky to get any more of it for obvious reasons. And if you have resistance to pyrethroids, I mean, that's half of the registered active ingredient list right there. Gone if you have this problem. So, yes, it's substantial. There are alternatives on the market today. Indoxacarb is an active ingredient representing a completely different mode of action group. So how it kills the insect is different from how a pyrethroid would do so. So that's definitely an opportunity there. And then there's another active ingredient called spinosad. It's registered for, it's a suppressant insecticide. So basically it suppresses the population. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about this distinction. So when a chemical company says this insecticide will control population, there's numbers behind that statement. This insecticide is going to kill 90%, if not more, of the population in your field of an insect that you're trying to manage. What a suppressant insecticide does is that it kills around 70%. That's why there's a distinction in the word choice. And as crazy as this may sound, what people say matter. And in this instance, it really has an impact when it comes to the percentage of the population that may remain in your field if you apply an insecticide.
Wow. So go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, so if you spray something that just has suppression on it and it only kills 70% at best, I mean, that's, you still got a problem, right?
Yes. So depending on how great the population density is in your field, if you remove 70%, the 30% that remain may be well above economic threshold, right? So you may still be facing economic damage because of this pest, even after you spray a suppressant, or, like, you know, a insecticide that might be registered as a suppressant insecticide.
So is there a benefit to, let's say I go out and I'm going to spray the herbicide or a pesticide that is a suppressant, and then can I come back in a week later and spray one that's only going to have 90% efficacy? So I'm thinking if I can kill 90% of the 30 remaining, is that a two application, two different, you know, active ingredients? Mm-hmm. Does that have merit, or are there other things that a grower can do to help alleviate the problem?
Great question. You're going to learn about my criteria, and my opinion on this is probably distinct from many others. I'm an insecticide purist. I want to know what I'm putting down and what my population has been exposed to. So one of the best ways to manage insecticide resistance is by rotating mode of action groups. So if you mix, or if you apply two different insecticide mode of action groups within the same year, that selection pressure is felt equally between the two sort like toxins that you're applying. So for me, I would want to know, okay, I for sure sprayed this mode of action group this year. I can't go back to it for another 3 years because I want to keep my population as susceptible to the tools in my toolbox as I possibly can get them. So, but everybody has their own recommendations when it comes to this. I'm just speaking from my own ideal scenario, right? Every farm's different.
Yeah, we tend to tank mix a lot of different modes of action when we talk about weed resistance, but I can see how you would like to track it specifically by one active ingredient and know that, you know, that one's checked off.
Right.
And I never thought of it putting the same amount of pressure. How did you say, can you repeat how that was? If you have a tank mix, those two AIs are putting the same amount of pressure equally on the target.
Generally speaking, yes. I mean, some mode of action groups might be better tailored to certain species than others. So in that instance, if you're trying to handle an entire complex of pests, it's warranted to do so. But just know that if it has any impact on your desired pest of concern, right, in this instance, that would be the alfalfa weevil, then that selection pressure may be felt equally between the two. So that's something to bear in mind whenever you're trying to figure out, all right, what should I throw at this pest?
You said something else. If you use an active ingredient, then you don't want to use it again for 3 years. So if I've got an alfalfa stand that I'm hoping is going to be out there, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. I mean, that I'm pretty limited because I think, you know, in my mindset, it would be like, well, I got that weevil, I'm going to spray Warrior this year. And then next year I got weevil, let's just go spray Warrior again. And which leads to the problems that you're studying. I guess on the average life of an alfalfa stand, you know, do you have enough that you can rotate every 3 years?
Great question. So, I showed my hand a little bit. So, this recommendation of no more than once every 3 years came from my PhD work, where we did field trials every year on a ranch in Montana, and there we tracked regained efficacy. So this farm had a huge issue with alfalfa weevil. I mean, their resistance was so extensive that to kill half of their population, they needed to exceed the maximum label rate of lambda-cyhalothrin by 10 times.
Oh my gosh.
You can't legally do that.
No.
You can't do that. Just to kill half, you cannot do that. And so they switched their management to the application of indoxacarb for 5 years. So over the duration of my PhD, annually, we took data out of that farm. And what we found was that there was, after reducing that selection pressure, right, totally removing yourself from that, from pyrethroid insecticides for consecutive years, there was regained efficacy documented over the duration of that PhD work. So
of the pyrethroids?
So just walk away from pyrethroids for 5 years. It's okay to go to indoxacarb for that period of time. If you can financially handle that, because it's, you know, if you go with the general insecticide on the market today, it runs about 6 times more than pyrethroids, ballpark wise. So it's more costly. So yeah, so he walked away for about 5 years from that entire mode of action group, and we tracked it. And what we found was that by reducing that selection pressure, you have regained efficacy of pyrethroids. And so if you are a rancher or a farmer that is trying to protect your field from this problem, you need to rotate your mode of action groups. Do not apply the same one more than once every 3 years, because it all has to do with that selection pressure and try and diversify it as much as you can.
Have you factored in any, is there a benefit to actually rotating your alfalfa fields and maybe not trying to get them to, you know, last as long as you normally would, but hey, I'm going to get 3 years out of this stand and then I'm going to rotate, to help break that resistance cycle also.
Not necessarily something that I've looked at, but I know that there are researchers that have taken the time to look at cut schedule, to look at different management strategies available to them. Rhonda Jabor at University of Wyoming would be the person I would call to get the answer to that question.
Hmm. What about BT or anything like that? Is there anything any opportunity or possibilities with those types of products?
Great question. At this time, there's been no data coming out of basically anywhere in the contiguous United States looking at BT. I do have to say, though, that there was a paper that was published out of Iran in 2013 looking at the benefit of BT on the management of alfalfa weevils, and what they found was that it was efficacious. Whether or not the data holds true here in the United States has yet to be seen, but that's the only publication that I'm aware of where they've looked at BT and the alfalfa weevil.
Is the alfalfa market, is it big enough for seed companies to look at putting some of these traits in there, or is it still, a minor enough crop that they just can't make the investment?
That's another good question. What I can say, and I think this is just a larger description of alfalfa as it stands today, and that is, it's not to say that there aren't any tools in the toolbox for alfalfa growers to use to manage this pest. I think when it comes to evaluating whether or not a company looks at their R&D budget and says yay or nay on it, a lot of it has to do with, okay, well, would the price point increase for this trait be something that a farmer or rancher can reasonably invest in on their farm? If pyrethroids work, I mean, they're cheap and people trust it, and with good reason. I mean, it's a very good insecticide. There's a reason why there's a whole bunch of resistance problems when it comes to this insecticide group. And so that's something that when it comes to looking at R&D, one has to look at it with a fine tooth comb and really dig in. And at this time, I'm not aware of any such efforts. That being said, I've only been in this position for 9 months, so my vantage point is relatively limited. But I do want to take some time here and discuss what people can do outside of the application of pyrethroids or indoxacarb, and that is cultural and mechanical and biological control strategies. So integrated pest management in a nutshell. So, all right, buckle up.
Okay.
So one thing to consider is that it's long been touted that harvesting 7 to 10 days early is a great way of reducing alfalfa weevil pressure. And I'm not going to disagree with it, but what I am going to say is that you have to do so very strategically. You have to dry down that plant material very, very fast. You have to rake as soon as you possibly can to desiccate the larvae that were caught up in the harvester. And you also have to make sure that your stand can tolerate that kind of traffic. I mean, it's relatively early in that plant's development. 7 to 10 days early is a pretty substantial chunk.
Yeah.
You're going to get fantastic quality hay if you cut on that schedule, but you're going to lose out on tonnage. And not everybody wants out of the park amazing forage quality. Some people want bulk yield, which is totally reasonable. There's only one trait on the market that can accommodate this management practice, and that is Harvextra alfalfa. Another benefit of it is that because of it can have an extended harvest window, you can recoup any lost yield due to harvesting 7 to 10 days early. So you can utilize that management strategy without totally sacrificing the tonnage that you anticipate to have for that year. Another thing to consider is that peak alfalfa weevil populations occur around first harvest. So if you're going to go down the insecticide application route, being able to delay harvest or accommodate delayed harvest to allow for reentry interval or for the make sure that any residual will be off of that field by the time it comes to harvest. I mean, Harvextra can accommodate that as well. Grazing your alfalfa in the fall and winter is actually quite good because alfalfa weevils overwinter in that field, and the debris at the base of this of the plant on the ground surface or in the stems of the plant. So if you have cow or sheep out there, they can trample any overwintering weevils that may be there, or they can chew on the stems, thus reducing the population that way.
We've seen this trend of wrapping hay bales. So and mm-hmm. it's so guys are, you know, especially in rain situations, we have a, you have a wet growing season, they'll go ahead and they'll get, you know, they'll get the forage cut, and then it's like, well, it's going to be wet, we're just going to bag it. You said you know, to get that thing dried out to get rid of the larvae. Does if bagging wet forage, does that on the alfalfa, does that exasperate the problem, or does it still help?
It can help as long, basically what I'm recommending is try to get that material off of the field as quickly as possible, whether it be drying it down quickly or baling it wet or taking it for silage. I mean, anything to get that material off of the field would be greatly beneficial, because what you do not wish to happen is that the weevil feeding will feed on the regrowth under the windrows. So what you, if not baled quickly or not removed quickly enough, what you'll see is streaks of serious defoliation, like dry leaf material throughout the field and in linear patterns, basically following the pattern of the windrows.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
It is interesting. So Harv Extra, what makes Harv Extra where that we can, you can get in there 7 to 10 days early? Cause that's, I guess that's in the name basically, is that you get an extra harvest out of that. You get an extra cutting by going on that type of schedule.
It can accommodate cutting 7 to 10 days early in that the subsequent cuts can be extended out for that period of time. So just general background on Harv Extra. It's a genetically modified plant. It's stacked with Roundup Ready technology, so it gives you an avenue for managing weeds. And it starts out, I would put it around 14 to 20% increase in quality. And so from that perspective, that's amazing. So if you can extend that harvest window out without sacrificing forage quality compared to conventional alfalfa varieties harvested at the same development stage. So that's what Harv Extra brings to the table. It has reduced lignin, so its digestibility is where you want it to be for your cows. Overall, it's a really impressive variety on the market today. And its utility in accommodating management strategies for insects, for weeds, is just amazing. We have some research plots out in Wisconsin, and there we did the extended harvest, basically collecting data by extending harvest up to, I believe it was like 34 days or something wild like that.
Wow.
And what it did was, because it has all of this biomass, all this forage canopy, it shades out weeds incredibly well. So we were able to track reduced weed pressure over the duration of that stand because of how we timed the harvest interval, because of the value of the Harv Extra that can accommodate such a harvest schedule. And you get overall healthier plants because it's not being stressed out.
Wow. Okay.
I've learned some things today.
I have too. I've made some notes here. This is good. So what should growers, so alfalfa growers in the next 3 to 5 years, it sounds kind of like, they may not realize they have the problem. That's kind of how it happened with water hemp a little bit with us, is that, you know, we kind of had a state of denial there for a while. We didn't think we had it, but we didn't think it was really our problem. And, so what should growers expect in the next 3 to 5 years regarding, alfalfa weevil management?
There's a few things that I can say, to your point about, not necessarily knowing you have the problem until it's time. If you have to spray pyrethroids 3 times in a singular year, you're there.
Okay.
You're there. One thing to consider that I know of right now is that in the industry as a whole, they're looking at label expansion to try and meet the needs of from a chemical standpoint. Whether or not that's feasible within the time frame that you are describing, I do not know. I'm not in the chemical ag sector. One thing I would also tell them to bear in mind, of course, is that whatever price point, let's say a label expansion were to happen, the first thing I would ask a farmer to look at is the price point, because it's in all likelihood, it's going to be patented material. So you will be paying a premium for that chemistry. And so it would be very important for whomever may be interested in buying it to do the number breakdown. Like, what does it cost me to spray pyrethroids three times in a singular season? And what does it cost me to spray once, the chemistry once in a singular season, and have really great control? So it's important to run the numbers, I would say.
If we had organophosphates, if we could still source Lor's Band and still had that tool, would that work?
I mean, hey, if you got that inventory in your barn,
yeah
it would work.
Well, maybe the EPA will bring Lor's Band, make alfalfa weevil spraying great again. Is that something that we could
do? I don't know.
I don't know.
It would help get rid of the grubs in my yard.
Dr. Rob Bell, do you have anything else that we should know? This has been very informative and very educational.
Yep. If you're interested in learning more about what traits are on the market today, I mean, I know we talked about alfalfa weevil, but there's a whole slew of varieties of alfalfa out there that can handle aphanomyces, for example, anthracnose. I mean, we talked about reduced lignin and Harvextra and its ability to accommodate pest management strategies. I mean, I would strongly encourage your listeners to go to harvextra.com. You'll have the calculator there to figure out its relative ROI, return on investment for your operation.
Very good. All right. Thomas has given me the nod that we can probably put that up there on the site. So that's awesome. Well, Dr. Yeah, Rob Bell, we're going to have you back. I'm sure there's more we can talk about, because this is one pest that's that really gets it's destructive in our alfalfa crop, and it's one of those things that we don't see it until we're, you know, driving down the road, right? Mm-hmm. Then we can see the damage.
Yeah. The amount of times I've wanted to pull over
I because bet.
I've seen skeletonization.
Dr. Rob Bell, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a blast.
All right.
Thank you.
That's another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Thank you all very much.